the MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. I'm Matt Broughton, Research Lead at ExchangeWire, and I'm delighted to be joined by this week's special guest, who is Rob Beeler, Founder and CEO of Beeler Tech. Hello to you, Rob.
Hello, great to talk to you.
Wonderful to have you on. And also joining us, fresh from her return from ATS Madrid, it's Rachel Smith, CEO of ExchangeWire. Hello to you, Rachel.
Hi, Matt. Hi, Rob. Delighted to be here. Feel like I'm a regular guest on the podcast again. Lucky me.
Oh, it's absolutely great to have you on with such frequency and regularity.
Yep. Hope listeners feel the same. It's all good.
I'm sure they do. We'll dive straight into the first news story of the week, and that is TikTok is introducing a new product which will allow publishers to offer ads on their videos. Pulse Premier, which is an extension of the short-form video giant's Pulse offering, will give participating publishers 50% of the revenue generated by the ads that follow their content. The move, which is a pivot away from TikTok's focus on independent content creators, opens up another revenue opportunity for the platform. TikTok Global Head of Monetization Product Strategy, Ray Tsao, says that Pulse offers advertisers more transparency over where their ad spend goes on the platform. Keen to get your guys' first impressions on this one, and a kind of first intro question to that. Is this a good deal for publishers? Rob, let's start with you.
So is it a good deal? Probably not, but I'll take it. And what I mean by that is that, you know, publishers need to start to learn from their past mistakes. There's doubt that TikTok is going to get their content in front of new audiences, something that's extremely important. Tying that to more direct revenue makes a lot of sense. And at the same time, it's kind of growing TikTok. And I just, again, I'll use the analogy. I hope this is appropriate, right? But it's like an addict that says, I'm off one drug, I'm just going to try another drug. We have been reliant on Facebook/Meta traffic a long time. That's drying up. Now we're stuck again. And so I feel like a lot of work is going to go into it from publishers to make the most of this offer. And I think over time, the terms will change and things will wane and whatever. And next thing you know, it's just going to feel like we're repeating the same kind of story. And yet, all that said, absolutely in.
That's so funny, Rob, because I was thinking to myself that it's sort of amusing that in a world where publishers stand to gain 50% of the revenue generated by advertising off the back of their own content that they've already paid to create and generate and all the rest of it, seems like a good deal. Like, what kind of a world is that, right? But it is 100% true. This is, you know, of course publishers are going to take it, and why wouldn't they? They should. They absolutely should. And, you know, this feels like a better deal than they've had from other social media platforms over time. So, you know, it's crazy that we're saying that, but it's also perfectly understandable.
I also just add that, you know, we all have to be thinking about, you know, Gen Z and the next generation, and, you know, publishers are brands. Sometimes they kind of feel like they don't think they are, but they are, and they need to get imprinted on the next generation to become sources for content. And this is, by the way, there's no scientific backing to this, but I feel like Gen Z is either extremely impulsive or extremely loyal. They love certain things without anything, or they're just impulsive. So it depends on what kind of publisher you are. Do you want to be the candy that's at the checkout counter that you just grab and you get a little snack bite? Or do you say, no, you need to come to me and experience me? I think each publisher use this as an opportunity to figure out the language of the next generation, which I think is the most important thing publishers need to be doing right now, is figuring out how to talk to people and audiences in new ways. TikTok's a great place to experiment with it. I just would not put all my eggs in that basket. I mean, I don't think anyone's suggesting that they do, but there is a part of it of going like, there'll be people who don't do this well. Yeah. And you know what? We'll enjoy it.
I mean, yeah, I think that's a good point, though, about brand building, because it's quite interesting the way that TikTok have built out this proposition, right? So the idea behind it is that, up to this point, I believe that content creators that get revenue off the back of advertising that are shown, that's shown just after their content, that's typically been sort of available only to the most popular posts that are coming from those content creators. Whereas now this is going to be an option to get that kind of revenue off the back of advertising on all content that is published on the platform, regardless of, you know, whatever they use to measure the popularity of it. So I think that's going to really extend publishers' opportunities to experiment, like you've just said, with the way in which they build their brand in this type of platform environment. So it's a fantastic sort of extra element of diversification for publishers for their revenue strategy. They absolutely should not be directing all their spend just to TikTok. This should be going to other places still as well. But I think the other thing that's interesting here is that, you know, this comes not that long after. I'm sure it was only back in March. Maybe it was February. Or in fact, maybe I'm confusing my 2023s with my 2022s, but it feels like it wasn't that long ago that Meta came out saying that they wouldn't be transferring any revenue to publishers off the back of advertising that appears near their content. So it's a, you know, from TikTok's point of view, I actually think this is a really clever strategy. It's a great way to diversify their own, you know, platform traffic and audience and revenue, because they'll get revenue off the back of this. And it's a great way for them to differentiate themselves from the other social media platforms from the perspective of attracting publishers to their platform.
Yeah, I see some potential copycatting with it. I don't think from Meta. I think, you know, to your point, I mean, Meta will at some point pivot again. I don't know what the next, you know, that one's hard to predict. Google, on the other hand, I mean, you know, the thought there is, I honestly think everything around Google is all about the regulation and where things stand. And if you look at this, them doing a copycat move might be a really good placation of like, oh, we are working with publishers closer. And that could be very good for publishers. It could be very good for Google. At the same time, it certainly opens up a door for them in terms of changing the relationship. And that's not, I think they just decide they easily want to do. I think they have to really kind of give that some thought and see whether this takes hold. But yeah, I do think that there's, I think the other part of it will be is, will these ads perform? Mm. How will publishers sell to it? There's some things there to be kind of worked out. But a brand like Condé on TikTok, I mean, is kind of a natural. There'll be some others that are just absolutely perfect. And then they're a publisher or not. And yeah. We'll just have to see how those play out and see CEOs doing dances, you know, little dance clips trying to.
You can't really see the BBC News doing a TikTok dance to introduce some bad news. But yeah, Condé Nast with their beauty magazines, and I think BuzzFeed have also been an initial one to sign up. That's more of a natural fit.
Reading the news about doing a little dance and skit like that. Yeah, you're right. Here's what's going on in Ukraine. Somehow, yeah. I think you're right. And at the same time, I probably would tune in.
I was going to say, that could be incredibly popular, right? Like, you know, it's in fact invariably the videos that make people cringe the most that have become the most viral. So bring it on. Little invitation out there to some of our, you know, well-known, trusted broadsheet publishers. Please do something exciting on TikTok for us. It would be very entertaining.
Absolutely. But it's interesting, like Metal's raised there, because they've kind of gone, yeah, they've recently announced a move that they will be paying creators based on the performance of their reels rather than simply the ad performance of their reels. But at the same time, they've also this week shown their, I think, true colours in their appearance in Canada about refusing to pay publishers for their news content and then doing the usual routine of spitting out the dummy and crying about the fact and then wanting to withdraw from the market. And they made a statement about it. And in that statement, it said, "It makes no sense to claim social media companies are taking money from publishers than to say car companies stole from the horse and cart industry." And I think that just shows their contempt for publishers, really. And I think it shows they think themselves as next generation publishers rather than the platform they, you know, more publicly claim to be.
Well, they would want to not even use that word, their next generation publisher, right? Because publishers have responsibilities.
Yeah, and they don't want those. They don't want those.
Everything to avoid any responsibility for what's going on with democracy to everything. And Yeah, I mean, again, we'll talk about this, I think, through the course of these other pieces, but like, it's just such a poor play on that part, and that's why I pay a little. Good luck to them.
Yeah. I think that's the most diplomatic way to express that. And I think it's what's really interesting about that story that came out in the press regarding the moves in Canada, Matt, is that, you know, they had to be brought to the table by legislators in Australia to broker something very similar under the ACCC, the Competition Authority in Australia, that passed some legislation a couple of years ago, you know, that concerned both Google and Facebook, as they were known at the time. And it was the exact same approach. No, we don't need to. Why do we need to? People don't come to our platform for news. This is all incidental content as far as we're concerned. And eventually they came to the table and negotiated, but only because they were forced to. And they also, you know, threatened to withdraw from the market. And I guess there's some comparators there, right? The Australian market's about the same size as the Canadian market. So it's sort of, you know, it's a strange kind of public relations approach, really, to just keep, you know, tunneling down this "we can do what we want" channel. I don't know if Nick Clegg still got his job at Meta, but I mean,
he does. He pulled out of a hearing because they changed the title of the hearing. So just
God, there's so much I could say about that. Let us not get dragged into British politics, though. Poor Rob will be going, "I regret this. I regret appearing on this podcast."
But yes, moving on from that very auspicious note of Nick Clegg into the second news story of the week, The Guardian has partnered with an ad tech company that will now be formally licensed to categorise its articles for contextual targeting. The tie-up with Illuma will help enable ads to be placed alongside relevant or related content on the newspaper's website. The publisher took aim at ad tech companies who scrape data from their site for contextual targeting without permission, stating that their activities create worse experiences for advertisers and for readers. The Guardian celebrated the partnership as a means to keep control over its intellectual property while remaining open around content distribution. First question to you guys is, will we see more agreements like this? Rachel, let's start with you on this one.
So firstly, I think this is a really strong move from The Guardian to be front-footed in terms of this issue regarding advertising technology vendors scraping content and data for contextual advertising purposes. So it's great to see. I would say that we would see more agreements like this depending on how successful this particular agreement is in tackling the three main issues that The Guardian prioritised when they were putting out their argument as to why they feel this is important. So that was that, you know, in the absence of a formal sort of, you know, legal agreement between the two parties, when content and data is scraped from their site and used for contextual purposes, it can very easily be incorrectly categorized, which can add, you know, all sorts of layers of complexity and take, you know, the entire industry's efforts at targeting advertising off into completely, you know, inappropriate directions. And then one of the second issues was that The Guardian claimed that unauthorized data scraping results in page load lags and delays, which of course is a terrible user experience and not beneficial to anyone. And then of course the third argument is a loss of advertising revenue, which they didn't, you know, for The Guardian, that's not necessarily their advertising. You know, they've got their advertising revenue model. They've also got their, you know, sort of donation subscription model. They didn't kind of really labour that point. But I know that, and I was a big supporter of it, I know that the AOP, when they released their open letter to the industry, really talked about how important that element is. Now, so therefore what I would say is that I think that agreements like this will become popular and we'll see more of them if this particular agreement tackles those issues, and especially the first two of those three issues, because I know there's debate around the third issue as to the degree to which it does actually impact advertising revenue. In any case, what I think underscores all of this, and I was really vociferous with my opinions when we talked about the AOP open letter to the industry a couple of weeks ago, the entire argument has got a moral grounding. And it is just not right. It's absolutely not right for anyone in the advertising value chain to be, undercutting how publishers are trying to monetize their business. It's, you know, publishers have had compromised monetization models for a long time. I know there's lots of arguments about what they've done to or not done to modernize their businesses and to kind of get with the program, but I don't think it's right that ad tech companies are scraping publisher content and data without some kind of an agreement in place that makes that a legitimate practice. And there you go. That's my soapbox. Go on, Rob. Prove me wrong.
And I would share a spot with you on that soapbox, but I know some of the counter argument and the things that we have to navigate. So first of all, I love that it's a move in this particular area. There's an aspect, to your point, I love the fact that you kind of said there's a moral aspect of this. For some reason, publishers can't say what their sites are about. Someone else comes in and tells them what their sites are about, which just to me is like, somehow there's just something wrong. Somehow I don't know my content as well as someone who uses some automated process to do so. And therefore I can't go out to the market. This in my publisher community is one of the biggest topics being discussed right now, brand safety, context, and so forth, because that's that. The thing, and I'll just say the counter argument, again, maybe I may not do the best job of this. I'm not great at debate club when I didn't get the conversation I wanted to actually win or believe. Been actually for some time. Google scrapes your site to index it and organize it. We want that, but we don't want someone else to do it so they can help advertisers. These companies would sit there and say they've enabled publishers to get revenue because they allow it for, you know, being able to buy across many sites based on context and so forth. So they're going to argue back that this is actually a really good thing. And there isn't, but at the end of the day, there's a couple things I've learned on this because I've really been trying to push on this. The major players in the space, like the Double Verifies, IASs, and so forth, Optimeras, all these companies have technology that can do it better than it actually has been implemented. The fact that there's still block lists, and again, I don't know if the last time either of you saw a block list, they are podcasting on it themselves. I would love to just sit there and read the words and we could decide why would people pick these words, right? But there's an aspect of going like, that's because either the brand or the agency or the technology hasn't gone to the next level of understanding these things. Okay.
Yeah.
So first of all, there's a lot on that particular part. But let's get back to the main point. The main point is, right, that will there be more of these types of deals? I hope so. I see it as a push forward from a publisher perspective that we need to do this right. I love the API model. I love that speed bump. I think that that's always important from a user experience to SEO and so forth. I just sit there and think that can The Guardian kind of hold the line? In other words, someone advertiser comes to them and says, we want to work with you, but we want to use our own version. Do they say no? I feel like The Guardian is in a position to say, no, we're not going to take that.
Yeah.
Other publishers will absolutely care. And so, but if there's a path here to do this in a much more equal way, I'm all for it. And I also support the AOP statement. I think that that's smart for us to raise this topic while we can still do something about it.
100%. Yeah. It's about actually tackling it. And, you know, you make a good point, Rob. I know there is a counter argument about what that contextual scraping has actually provided for publishers in a positive direction. But then I guess my thought is, well, then why not enter into a formal agreement with these publishers to continue doing that, giving them all the goodness, but also, you know, still getting something out of it for yourselves in an agreement, in a formalized agreement. And so, yeah, I just echo what you said. I hope we're going to see more of these agreements. And I'm pleased that The Guardian has been quite front-footed in establishing this one. And I think my other underlying feeling here is that although this has been going on for a long time, it just feels as though it's a somewhat subverted business practice, right? You're making something off the back of someone else's hard work without formally acknowledging that. And let's just stop doing that in the advertising and marketing technology industry. There's been too much of that going on, and we need to start behaving like grown-up, sophisticated adults. So let's try and, you know, diminish those practices as much as we possibly can.
Oh, Rachel. Oh, so naive, Rachel. this whole industry is based off taking what someone else has done and figuring out how to get your cut of. No, by the way,
I know. 100%. You're right.
I don't want to. Normally, I'm the one who plays that role, by the way. That's I feel like my role in the industry is like, why can't we just all work together to make this work?
Yeah. And
the misaligned incentives across the board. Yeah, I think that there's an aspect of this that I think the other big issue here will be how contextual plays out going forward. See, agencies and a lot of technology companies are really going for identifiers as the backbone of things. The fact of the matter is although this is going to be a mix of signals, and context will be a part of it, right? If you remember that Google just came out with their privacy sandbox tests, right? It was like the use of topics and PPID and some other signal, right? Like no one buys one of these things. No one goes, oh, I want to buy a contextual impression. Textual impression, geography, with anything else I know. And that really makes it hard to put value on any individual piece of that, right? We get rid of third-party cookies, more weight gets put on context. And if these deals are in place and this works, absolutely amazing. But it is going to have to perform. And to your point, I think there'll be a lot of people watching this. I just hope there's a lot more stirring the pot like this in actual action versus letters to the industry, right?
Indeed.
I mean, that's the other part. Like, this is a move. I love people who are sitting there trying to work the problem as opposed to hoping that people become adults in our industry, Rachel.
No, you're absolutely right. And so well done, The Guardian, for making a move. Let's see what happens next.
Yeah, absolutely. Moving into our third news story of the week, the Competition and Markets Authority has been asked by the UK government to examine the current state of AI. The watchdog is one of several regulatory bodies who have been tasked with investigating the impact of emerging AI technologies, with the aim of establishing guardrails around their development. The CMA probe will focus on foundation models that power chatbots, which have been the source of both excitement and concern in recent months. The regulator will explore how the competitive market for this technology could develop, the aim of developing guiding principles for this space. The potential risks and opportunities that programs like ChatGPT pose to consumers will also be reviewed. My first question to you guys is, how could regulation impact the development of AI? Rob, let's start with you.
Well, I think we all know that regulators and legislation have a perfect record of nailing this stuff and absolutely getting it right on the first try. That, by the way, is not a political leaning. That's just, looking at history.
State
that
of facts. Yeah.
Right. Technology outstrips our ability to regulate it. The cat is out of the bag on this. And at the same time, regulation is needed. I think there's just an aspect of how do we take legislative bodies that react to things that are today than where they're going to be. I literally just heard this conversation yesterday from a technologist who's like, in a couple of years, this is going to get very weird, how AI plays in our world. And to sit there and think that you can put a pin in something right now and say the way it should work isn't going to work. And I'll just throw this out there as a thought thing, right? Which is, we treat corporations as if they're people, right? And they therefore have rights, and you can sue them and you can do this and so forth. AI doesn't have any of that, meaning it's not a person, and therefore can you sue an algorithm? Can you, and keep in mind that you can certainly do things to prevent corporations from using AI. Individual, I sit there and I look at this and I go like, we have a whole new world in front of us with this, and we need to do something. I mean, again, I've got some other points on this. I want to hear Rachel's take on it. I'm getting too philosophical, I feel, right now. But there is a part of this of like, oh, yeah, regulation, nail it. Just put AI and put it in its place and let it grow slowly and methodically. Sure, let's do that.
That is 100% not what's going to happen, right? We all know that. I think what's interesting about this is that – it's coming in the first instance from, or, all the the legislators in question have been tasked with coming at this from a Competition and Markets Authority point of view, which means they're looking specifically at competition and consumer protection. Now, that's interesting, but what that's going to do is just look at how various companies use and apply AI and whether that infringes consumers' rights and whether that creates an anti-competition arrangement amongst other companies. All of that's super important, but it's only one tiny piece of the puzzle, right? Because AI is going to touch absolutely every corner of our lives if it's not already involved in most aspects of our lives. So I completely agree with you on the speed element. You know, will anyone be able to keep up with this fast enough to put some sensible guardrails, as they kept referring to in this article, in place that will enable then legislators to create some kind of boundaries and rules around those boundaries and ways for implementing those rules if things go wrong? Will we be able to handle all of that quickly enough? I mean, I think the basic answer to that is no, because we proved that we couldn't do it even just with data privacy and, you know, consumer control associated with personal data. You know, that's been, quite frankly, a shit show since 2016. Not saying that it's not getting better, it is, but it's taken us that whole period of time to really test the various legislation and legislative, you know, sort of models that we came up with and to try to work out how they're best applied and to try to tweak things along the way. And it's still a real mishmash of approaches. And we're still, I think, yet to see how that's actually going to take definitive shape in our lives and in society in general. Then there is the other part of my thought stream around this, which is that it's incredibly important for governments, politicians and legislators to get to understand artificial intelligence and the world of automation more than they no doubt already do at the moment. So I'd love to see this particular piece of work and anything else that follows it be principally a study of artificial intelligence, what it can do and what it's likely, where it's likely to be used and how that might proliferate before they even start talking about controls and legislation. They need to be doing that too. And to your point, Rob, they actually need to be doing that as fast as they need to be trying to understand it. But I feel like it's a very kind of quite typical approach from regulators and government authorities to just bowl in there and make an attempt to do, as you said, Rob, kind of put a pin in it or, you know, like put some boundaries around it immediately before they even understand what it is and how it's going to be used. The other thing that I think is fascinating about this is I was having a conversation with an APAC agency sort of exec and leader earlier on in the year who was talking about the pace of technology development and how quickly it's outstripping even our ability to educate ourselves and one another and kids about it. So, you know, we've seen in our lifetime technology leapfrog product development, leapfrog government legislation and practices and policy development. Now it's leapfrogging education practices. So in a way, we're sort of slightly losing the battle of keeping pace, and we definitely need to do something to close that gap. And so anything that takes us closer to that, to that ambition is a good thing. So I'm glad that this is being taken seriously enough that the government wants to implement some form of controls and legislation. But we need to speed it up and we need to do so many things in parallel, and it needs to be really sophisticated. And I'm going to just hedge my bets here and say that it's probably not really kicking off with a very sophisticated approach. I don't know. I don't work for the CMA, but, you know, they've got a million other things to be doing too, right?
But there's a real opportunity. I agree with everything there. I think there's an opportunity for us to try to educate legislators on these issues. And, you know, a quick story, and then I think I can actually tie all these articles together, but maybe Rachel, I want to get you in there. But there's a piece of this, like Beeler Tech, one of the things that we're going to be able to do in July, knock on wood, is actually go and meet with legislators in Washington, D.C. to talk to them about privacy regulation. Now, again, this hasn't happened and maybe I've jinxed it, but the reason that we've been asked to go there is because I can pull together publishers who have gone through what GDPR is like versus state in the U.S. and not the privacy policy people. We're talking about the people who are actually hands-on. And I feel like there's an aspect that we do this a lot with our industry and in our world of going like, I'm sure someone's talking to these legislators and regulators and informing them of how things really work. And I feel like we've done enough of that, just leave to those teams to do it. we need to inform them, and then we need to inform them more directly. Because I think one of the areas of this that really concerns me, and again, this is done to protect people. All of this comes down to the fact that investing and creating content costs money. It needs to be funded in some way. And if you start to put barriers up between you and only thing that goes through is the people who want to create content that they're willing to give away for free because they're doing it with some other purpose, mostly nefarious, right? Misinformation travels faster than real information, right? And so, but the product has changed, okay? It used to be newspapers, TV stations or whatever, and now it's TikTok people. See how I did that? So like TikTok performers are now creating content that is as engaging as that cost $1 million to make, right? I can spend all night on TikTok and whatever. And the advertising, the way it flows through all of this is different. Who gets paid for it is different. And I feel like there's an aspect of this that AI is going to flood the internet with content that may or may not be accurate. And I feel like that's something that we should put in the consumer's interest to do that right. Because, and then the fact of the matter is AI might be good enough for them without them even knowing that, right? Like, in other words, we sit there and go like, oh, you know, you wouldn't want something that isn't a real painting. I don't know. I've played with Midjourney. It's pretty freaking cool. I could spend all day doing just typing in random things about my friends and seeing, putting them as superheroes and all that kind of stuff. It's awesome. ChatGPT. It only occurs to me now, Rachel, that I should have wrote my notes using ChatGPT.
Yeah, totally.
I handwrote them. How old fashioned am I? Yeah. Right? How January of 2023 am I? You know?
Exactly. So, right.
All of this ties to just this idea that like we've got to change the conversation with how we talk about these things with the people, with the legislation, so we start to drive this in directions. And Rachel, I'm going to go to your naive part for the right reasons, as opposed to we want to keep taking people's data because it keeps our businesses thriving off oil that probably is not oil we should be able to use. I don't know if I'm mixing my analogies there, but you know where I'm going with that. So anyway,
That's a great thread. And I think the sort of further subsequent point that I had noted about this article is that I feel like it's got a very strong correlation with the importance of protecting good quality, thought-led, independent information, you know, journalism and content, and that there is a strong societal purpose to getting on top of the proliferation of artificial intelligence and the ways in which those AI tools are developed and used. And that should be the principal point from which all of these inquiries are starting, right? But further to your point that this can some, you know, that this is a somewhat sort of naive interpretation of life. Unfortunately, everything that's controlled by government somewhere along the line has got a slight political motivation associated with it. So it'll be a priority today because somebody's decided it needs to be a priority today. Not saying that that means that there are things that don't, you know, retain their importance throughout various political administrations, but we all know that things get driven according to particular political ambitions. And then on the commercial side of it, I do understand that, you know, everyone in our industry, just like any other industry, is protecting a business model somewhere along the line because it's important. And it might not be important altruistically just to themselves. It might also be important for the 10, 20, 50, 250, 300 people that they employ. I get all of that. But I do think that there is something about, you know, and those of us working in this industry for a long time will have been familiar with this feeling of being at the sharp edge of tech innovation. And all of the fun and excitement that goes with that, as well as the, oh man, does that mean that this tool could actually do that? That's kind of creepy. That's kind of wild. That's kind of scary. And I feel like the pace of that has accelerated enormously, even in just as you referenced pretty much, Rob, the last 6 months. So I do think this is an inflection point. And, you know, if it's not for the greater good, if it's even just for trying to contain and control the way businesses establish themselves and the reasons for which they employ people and how they make money, we need to get to grips with this sooner rather than later.
I can't think of a better place to stop. I'll add one thing. Yesterday, Google announced they're putting watermarks, you know, on some of the things and the tools they're using. So big tech and some of these companies have a part to play in this. But I think to your absolute point, we as an industry, again, I really love that point you just made, is that AI is obviously bigger than our industry. And yet our industry is uniquely in a position to understand the implications. I don't think I've ever heard that or thought about that, but it does mean that there's an aspect that we as an industry could lead some of this conversation down the right path.
That's great that you may well be, hopefully, ending up having conversations with legislators in Washington. That's brilliant, because I completely support that. I think industry bodies, associations, organizations, smart people in the industry that want to represent, the argument from an independent point of view should absolutely be collaborating with legislators to help them understand what the hell it is that they're dealing with.
Absolutely. Moving into the second part of our podcast now, where we find a bit more about Rob and what he's working on at Belatech. Obviously, Rob, you've touched upon work with legislators, but yeah, what's going on at Belatech? And for those
I'm ready to take that question. We're doing a lot at Belatech, and again, just real quickly, because I'm sure people listening to your podcast don't necessarily know what Belatech is, and there's an aspect where a lot of people struggle as to what we do. We have a community of publishers that we focus on to create conversations, talk about these types of topics in a safe environment so that we can kind of just share, then work with technology companies who are trying to reach those publishers in any number of different ways, in ways that are meaningful both for all parties. We are doing a number of events. I'm actually, the next thing that's really exciting, I'm doing an event for the Canadian market June 1st, called Digital Day Camp. I'm excited because the Canadian market, and Rachel, you referenced this earlier, different market than the US, smaller, different set of players, different rules. And so I'm really excited about that. But then I fly to London and I'm going to be a part of ATS. So I'm going to be, leading some panels and emceeing, and then we're doing some publisher breakout sessions at ATS London, and couldn't be more excited about being a part of what you all do.
That's we're delighted to have you on board for that, Rob. We're super excited about it too. Also, because it's our first effort to run kind of concurrent streams at the event and to have really explicit conversations in particular parts of the venue on particular topics. So we're delighted that you'll be spearheading that with us and helping us out with it. Chief of Question role here. Because you said earlier on that, content and data scraping was one of the major concerns that you've been, some of your publisher colleagues have been dealing with. What are some of the other key things that are coming through in terms of stuff that publishers are mostly focused on for 2023?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, a couple of things come to mind, right? So one is, it is really hard right now to future-proof what's going to happen without third-party cookies, right? We understand that publisher-party data is like the one thing that we can activate and we can work on, and yet the buyers are not going to put value on that until they kind of need to, right? Mm-hmm. I feel like there's a part where there's enough cheap third-party data out there to do that. So it's hard to get signals as to whether identifiers are working, data clean rooms, all of these things. And keep in mind with all of it, I'm wondering where the regulation stops. And again, if I can go on this tangent, which is, I truly believe in privacy as a right. So I feel like there's a spot there where we're doing it. But the regulators really came at this as a way to get big tech to pay taxes in countries they weren't paying taxes in. So at what point do they decide they've gotten enough money that they stop? Mm. And will hashed emails and data clean rooms be on the right side of that or on the wrong side of it? If regulators stop, will consumers continue to push? I don't know. And so everyone's sitting there trying to figure out where all of this goes, right? What is truly privacy compliant? I don't know what it is 2 or 3 years from now. Hard to build on that. What we talk about with our publishers and what they're talking about is controlling what you can, your audience, building these products, understanding contextual, how it's being scraped, what's happening there, so we can start to actually control our futures. That's the biggest thing on the publisher side is we have continually given away the reins to ad tech and then gone, wow, we got ripped off again. And so I feel like there's an aspect that this creates that particular moment. I think the other thing that's a big discussion point is, are SSPs now DSPs and are DSPs SSPs? And I think we can go to Kieran on this one, that everyone's an ad network. I know Eric's saying it the same, Mobile Dev Memo or whatever. Yep. I've always believed that, right?
Yeah.
Everyone's a network. We just put a bad word. We just took a word out of our vocabulary because we demonized it. At the same time, that's what everyone's doing. So let's get back to that.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Those are exactly all of the conversations that we were having in and around ATS Madrid earlier on this week, actually, was just, you know, what's happening on the tech side of the industry in terms of disintermediation, where you've got DSPs and SSPs battling it out for very similar ground in terms of relevance to clients and customers. And then you got Kieran in the background going, it's because everyone's an ad network. And that sort of somehow is, you know, just the summary point there. And then also, it's interesting hearing you reflect that conversation around the future of identifiers and, you know, what actually, how publishers are building out, you know, good quality first party data businesses and what that will actually mean for advertising going forward. And it's just really interesting hearing you reflect that from the publisher perspective and the publisher point of view, because we hear the other side of it so often. You know, we find ourselves talking so much about why brands and marketers should want to advertise in a privacy compliant environment and what actually does that mean and how they, you know, what signals do they optimize towards to find audiences in new places. And it's great to have the publisher voice reflected back to us. And I suppose not at all surprising that everyone's asking the same questions no matter which side of the value chain they're sitting on.
I did a virtual roundtable. It's one of the things I do where I pull a small group together and talk about a particular topic. And I bought both the buy side and the sell side together. This was early days. And I basically said, are you putting your weight on contextual or first party data? Everyone to a person said first party data. And then I had to kind of remind the room that when the buyer said first party data, they meant their first party data. And by the way, the publisher said first party data, they meant their first. It's almost like people didn't get that carryover. And then suddenly it's like, oh, we really didn't come together there, did we? Like, no, you didn't. Look, first party data is used today quite successfully. Publisher first party data is used. There's a lot of deals that happen that use that. I do that with my work at golf.com. People love our segments that we have around us, and it works. Programmatically is where the trust factor goes down to zero, and it goes more for some reason to third-party sources, to which I am every gender, I am every age group, I'm buying a car, I'm doing everything else that you might do just because I happen to click around the internet in whatever way that I do, versus being on a publisher site where they know something about me because I have a relationship. That's the other part I'll just say, and I'll stop here. Consent is going to be one of the most important things. Publishers are the ones that are getting the consent for there to be ads to actually be served or any tracking. And that is a privilege to work with a publisher that can get that in the future.
Yeah.
And right now it's just, it's table stakes. Yeah, of course you're going to send on whatever you can. And I feel like, you know, the Guardian's making this move. I think they're making this move as well, and just sit there and say that relationship with the user, you know, go ahead and try and get that brand. It's harder than you think. Hmm. You can do it on TikTok, but then you don't control it, right? Like all these things play out that publishers have a future, and it's just based on that audience, and they just have to focus on new ways to talking to them to get that consent. So, Fox.
Well, I'm loving the soapbox debating. And also part of that is around, you know, this principle that I mentioned earlier of building sustainable business models, whether you're a publisher, whether you're a marketer, advertiser, brand, whether you're an agency for that matter, whether your area of specialism is, you know, supporting the service layer. The point is you need to be confident that you've got a business model that you own. You know, so if you're a publisher, it is knowing everything you can possibly know about your readers and your customers and consumers and having to, you know, doing everything you can to have that relationship, to own that relationship. And that will, even if it's not abundantly clear right now, that strength of business model will be the sustainable element that will keep you competitive in the future. At least that's what it looks like from where I'm sitting. Because quite frankly, I don't know anyone that's had a sustainable business model, no matter what the industry, if they haven't been thoroughly confident about their product, the quality of their product, and the people that they're selling that product to. So,
yeah, I feel like that's done editorially. I think from a publisher perspective, when it comes to advertising, and I've tried to use this analogy, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but it'd be like a publisher having a pizza shop. But here's the model of the pizza shop. I'm going to make pizzas and I'm all sorts. And you just get to come in and just take what you want and then just pay me whatever you feel the slice is worth. Right. And I'm just going to keep pumping out as many slices as I can to try to cover my costs while someone comes in and picks up off the pepperonis and this, whatever. For some reason, this model, this whole thing is set up for publishers to go like, please tell me what I'm worth. And I just sit there and think about like, who wants to work that way? I mean, again, Exchange Wire, please move to your ATS model going like whatever you want to pay for the sponsorship and the tickets. It's up to you guys. Come in freely. Stay for as little as you want. Cherry pick that you're going to do this and grab attendees away. Yeah, let's just have a free-for-all. And somehow from an advertising perspective, that's kind of how it's set up.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, that'd make a hell of an interesting ATS because all bets would be off about the quality of the content on stage as well. So it'd be pretty exciting to see what happened. But not sustainable is my point, and your point too. Not sustainable.
Right. That's not what we're doing in ATS London, just for everyone that's listening. You have to buy a ticket.
You're going to have to pay to get in, folks.
We're going to have structure and so forth. Yeah. Someday we'll throw together an event. In fact, I was talking to
called the AdTech Free for All. I think that's a great idea.
I'm working on an award show where you get to pick whatever award you want and you get it. So that way it's just like, you know, that way if you want to be best dressed in ad tech, it's your award.
It's yours.
Yeah. Not sure the business model.
I think that's great. I'd love to know how you deal with any conflicts where you've got a couple of people tripping over themselves for best dressed or, you know, I don't know, biggest legend of ad tech, because that's what Kieran would be going for, obviously.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'd wait for him to put in his bid and then I would copy that and get, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, again, free for all. So we'll do that. We'll plot that out at some point and someone can help us figure out the business model.
Sounds great.
Exactly. We'll all crunch the numbers on ATS free for all and come back to you listeners. But that just about draws us out of time. But guys, it's been an absolutely fascinating conversation and it's interesting the juxtaposition between future focused looking into AI and cutting edge business models there and then coming back to everyone's an ad network. But yes, it's been absolutely fascinating. Rob, thanks ever so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure having you.
Thank you.
Rachel, absolute pleasure as always.
Thank you very much.
And thanks ever so much for listening. That was this week's MadTech Podcast.